59, which is probably the most extensive creation account that deals with the origin of the human beings. And as I promised two Sundays ago, we're going to wrap up our study in Psalm 139 by taking you through some material we've developed on the origin of humanity. And we have a keynote presentation that will take you through that. But to set the stage, let me read the relevant parts of Psalm 139. O Lord, you've searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You were familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in, behind, and before. You've laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. In other words, King David, inspired by the Holy Spirit, is laying out for us just how important each one of us are in the eyes of God. He determines the day that we are conceived. He determines the day that we will die. He determines everything that will happen in between our conception and our death. And what we see here is that, yes, it is the physical intercourse of the father and the mother that knits together the body of a human being in the womb of the mother. But it's God who creates the spirit anew at the point of conception. King David, when he wrote Psalm 51, made the point that we are God's spirit is placed within us at the point of conception. And so it's a union of the Father, the Mother, as well as God's Holy Spirit in creating a human being. Because unlike animals, we are spiritual. We're the one species that's body, soul, and spirit. And God's responsible for creating the soul and the spirit of the human being in the womb of the mother. And so this means that we must have a very high standing in God's eyes. And so I'm going to kind of take you through a little presentation we've prepared here. Yes? Yeah, there's a lot of debate about what he's referring to, and he says he's made in the secret place. And most theologians make the point that it's not just referring to the darkness inside the womb of the mother. You know, inside the womb of the mother, it's completely dark. Almost completely dark. There's infrared radiation there, of course. but most scholars believe it's referring to the fact that the spirit that God creates and joins to the body of the newly conceived human being, that's what was made in a place that will be forever a secret to us human beings, at least in this present creation. And so if they look at that passage as one that's making the point that we're not just a mass of cells. We're more than that. We're not just physical life. We're spiritual life as well. And that's something that God knit together in, quote, the secret place. So, but good insight there. Now, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, when you look at what the Bible teaches about the origin of human beings, it introduces it in the context of the three origins of life. And if you look at Genesis chapter 1, it speaks about the origin of physical life at the beginning of creation day 1, which we'll review shortly. And then it talks about God creating soulish life, referring to the higher animals that are endowed with mind, will, and emotions so that they can nurture and relate to one another, but also form relationships with human beings. So So that's the second origin of life. And then the third origin of life is when God creates the one species here on earth that's body, soul, and spirit. So it's making the point that there are three distinct forms of life here on planet Earth. Life that's purely physical, good examples of that would be bacteria and insects. And then life forms that are not only physical, but also soulish. Good examples of that would be birds and mammals, and how they can relate to one another and also relate to us human beings, and how they're endowed with the capacity to serve and please human beings, each in their own distinct way. And then finally, on creation day 6, God makes that one species, that's body, soul, and spirit. So creation day 1 is the first origin of life. Creation day 5 is the second origin of life. Creation day 6 is the third origin of life. And so Genesis 1 teaches these three different origins of life, bacteria being the example of one. Here's some soulish animals, and then just the one species, that's body, soul, and spirit. Now, what I want to do, we've actually had quite a long lesson on the second origin of life when we were going through Job 38 and 39. So we're going to actually focus on the first origin of life as it focuses on the origin of human beings. And hopefully you'll see how the first origin of life does connect with the origin of human beings. So the three origins of life. Now, when you read Genesis chapter 1, it tells us in verse 2 that the world began formless and void, tohu wabohu. It's a phrase that's used a few times in the Old Testament, sometimes referring to something that is wasted and incapable of supporting life. But the simplest interpretation is, in the beginning, the world was unfit for life and it was empty for life. But Genesis 1:2 follows up by saying the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. So here's planet Earth, in a state where it's unfit for life, it's empty for life, but then the Spirit of God begins to hover or brood over the surface of the waters. Most translations will say hover, a few will say brood, and it's based on the Hebrew verb rahat, and it's a subject of some debate because it's found only two times in the entire Bible. The only other place you're going to find it is in the Song of Moses in the book of Deuteronomy. And there in the book of Deuteronomy, yes, got a question? Yeah, Al.
Yeah. Where in this creation of human life, the three or four other hominins that exist at the same time as humans?
Okay.
They
would fall in the category of the second origin of life. They were physical, they were soulish, but they were not spiritual. And so we're going to get into some of the evidence that proves that they were not spiritual beings. So that's going to be coming. That's going to be part of this. But that's an important issue. And one reason we're going to spend some time on this whole subject of the origin of humanity is now a very aggressive debate within the Christian community. I've been to three apologetics conferences this past year. In every case, this was a subject of a quite heated debate. Theistic evolutionists, for example, are strongly promoting the idea that there was no Bara-type intervention to create the first human beings. And so that's the subject of major debate today. In fact, I would suggest it's going to be a major debate for probably the next 3, 4, or 5 years. But in one context, the origin of the first life has a bearing on the origin of the third form of life. Because this is something I also saw at these conferences where we were interacting with theistic evolutionists, is that at least the theistic evolutionists we were interacting with were not prepared to concede that there was supernatural intervention involved on any of the three origins of life. And we were operating the presumption, well, surely they recognize that there's a miraculous intervention for the first origin of life, but we found that not to be the case. So that's one reason why I'm kind of looking at the origin of humanity in the context of all three origins of life, because all three come up in this debate that's now taking place within the Christian community. And I do believe that they're related, and it's important to integrate the three origins of life in order to develop a scientific and a biblical resolution. But just to focus on this verb, rahab, it shows up twice in the Bible, Genesis 1, and in the book of Deuteronomy, the Song of Moses, chapter 32 there. And in what you see there in Deuteronomy is that it's used with reference to a female eagle that's hovering over her newborn chicks. And because of that second context, there are Bible scholars are saying that here in Genesis 1-2, likewise the Holy Spirit is hovering or brooding in such a way as to bring life about in the waters of a planet Earth. And therefore, we've argued in the book that we've written on the origins of life that the biblical position is that life shows up at the beginning of creation, day one. And what you see in Genesis 1-3 is the opening phrase, let there be light. And with light now passing through the atmosphere of the earth, there would be the possibility for photosynthetic life existing on the surface of the earth. Without that light, that would not be possible. And we studied the book of Job. Job 38, 8 and 9 tells us that it was dark upon the seas of the earth, referring to the ocean that covered the whole surface of the earth, because God had blanketed the seas with clouds that kept the seas dark. And so that helps clarify a major debate. This came up, by the way, in the conference we had in North Carolina, where young earth creationists were insisting that there was no light at all until creation day three. But if you examine Job 38, 8, 9, it tells us there was light in the heavens, in the universe, but it was dark on the surface of the waters because of the fact that God had blanketed the earth with clouds that kept it dark. And so with the appearance of light would now be the possibility of photosynthetic life. And therefore, we take the position that right at the very beginning of creation day one, we have God intervening to supernaturally create the first life on the earth. And in that context, you come up with these biblical predictions that in terms of the origin of life, we would anticipate that it would be early, that it would be under hostile conditions, tohu wabohu, formless and void, that life would be complex, diverse, and abundant. You say, where do you get that from? Well, what we see in Psalm 139, as well as Psalm 104 that we studied previously, is that God is extremely aggressive in packing the planet Earth with as much life, with as diverse of life as possible for as long as possible, which means that he's going to create life as early as the physics will permit that he had set up. And when he does create life, he's not going to limit himself to just one species. We're going to expect that there will be multiple species and that the life would be abundant on the face of the earth as early as possible. You say, why is God doing it this way? His goal is that when he creates human beings, we human beings would be pre-endowed with the maximum biological resources, both living and dead. And so when God creates Adam and Eve, he creates Adam and Eve in a context where hey, they have the greatest possible biological resources to draw upon in terms of the species that are currently living, as well as all of the species that God had created previously that had laid up a treasure chest of biodeposits into the crust of the earth, so that human beings can quickly launch civilization, turn that civilization into a global high-technology context, which would enable the human species to quickly fulfill the commands that God has given to the human species in the context of bringing the good news of Jesus Christ to the entire world's population, which is requiring a global high-technology civilization, which in turn requires that human beings be pre-endowed with this superabundant biodeposits as well as the biological resources of living species. And in terms of what we see in Psalm 139 and Job 38 and 39, Psalm 104, as well as Genesis 1, that the creation of life would be miraculous, it would be instantaneous. And we see here in Genesis 1, it would be marine life only. Why? Because water covers the whole face of the earth. It's not until creation day three that we have land masses appearing above the surface of the waters. So that's the biblical context. Now I'm going to contrast that with the non-theistic perspective. Yes, Steve. I'm going to write that down so I can check it out. Jeremiah
23:9.
Yeah, but are you claiming that there is land masses on creation day one, or just... Well, okay. This is a subject of a debate that we had in 1990 at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and the interpretation that you're suggesting was very strongly promoted by Bruce Waltke, the idea that Genesis 1:1 was a title and was not talking about the origin of the universe as a whole. And not until we get to Genesis 1:3 do we have any kind of chronology being stipulated. So he was taking the point of view that Genesis 1:1 and 1:2 were not part of the chronology. We had some interesting discussions over lunch because we had Walt Kaiser, Gleason Archer, and Cancer, who was the one who was sponsoring the dialogue that we were having. And what we heard from Bruce Waltke was, well, he did agree with the rest of us that the chronology is something that would be the most natural interpretation of the text, but he says it's at fault with the scientific record. So one of the reasons why he took the idea that it was titles, he says if we don't, then we have a conflict with the text. But at least from our perspective of reasons to believe, we have no problem seeing the entire thing as a chronology. We do see it as a perfect fit with a scientific record. But what I've noticed, I saw this too in our dialogues with the theistic evolutionists in Austin, Texas, is that their big concern was, if you don't take these things as titles, then you've got a chronological conflict with the scientific record. But our material here, we're pointing out that there's no need to be alarmed at the fact that there's going to be a problem with the chronology. There's actually a perfect fit. Well, Steve, let me stop you there. I mean, I've been very concerned about the time chart we have up there because of the fact that it doesn't adequately state the errors that we have in those various dates. Those errors are enormous. And so it can look like, and I agree with you, it looks like that the fourth day is squished down to virtually no time at all. But when you recognize that the error bars are over 100 million years on both the third day, the fourth day, and the fifth day, well, the fifth day is not that bad, then we realize, okay, it may be a lot longer than it looks on the chart. And so I've been on record to say, you know, I really don't like putting these charts up there. It's good for the chronology, but it's not good in terms of the dates.
I'll leave it at this.
Yeah. Yeah, what I'm saying is that it's from the science that we get the large error bars. The scientific dating for the events of the building up of the continental land masses, for example, are known to no better than about plus or minus 100 million years. The great oxygenation events, likewise, early oxygenation events have very large error bars. We know they took place. And the latter oxygenation events are accurately timed. But the first oxygenation event has quite a large error bar. Well, I'm saying I basically agree with you that the fact that we have scientific uncertainties makes it very difficult to tell when the fourth day begins and when the fourth day ends. That, I would argue, has significant uncertainty. I'm not claiming we're squeezing it, all right? Okay. So, I mean, I'd agree with you, it could be squeezed. I mean, I just see that as something that we can't pin down with any certainty, biblically or scientifically, at this point. All right. But I would make the point that there's plenty of biblical evidence that the primordial earth was devoid of continents and land masses. It's not just Genesis 1. There's several other creation accounts, many of which we've already been through, that make the point that you're looking at a marine situation for the primordial Earth, which would support the idea that you'd expect the first life forms to be marine life forms, since land masses are not yet popping up above the surface of the waters. And, of course, from a scientific perspective, the evidence for that is overwhelming. It would take a significant period of time for the plate tectonic activity to build up any land masses of any significance. Well, that's the biblical perspective. At least it's the biblical perspective from Reasons to Believe. I would agree that there are Christians who would take a different perspective than what we have here. But this is the perspective that we take. And from a non-theistic perspective, I did have the opportunity in the 1970s of taking a course from Charles Darwin where he talked about the origin of, not Charles Darwin, Carl Sagan. But Carl Sagan quoted Charles Darwin by saying, if you read what he had written, how life arose from a warm pond. But Carl Sagan was critical of Charles Darwin in saying that Charles Darwin thought all we needed was a small warm pond for a brief period of time. And that's because in the days of Charles Darwin, they thought that bacterial life was incredibly simple. They basically saw it as a membrane encapsulating some jelly-like substance that later became called a cytoplasm. And the presumption was that this jelly-like substance inside the cell was of a very simple molecular level, and it was all identical all the way across. And Carl Sagan made the point that we now know a lot better. Cells are much more complex than that, and therefore we can't expect life to arise naturally in a small, warm pond over a few centuries. He said, what we're going to need is a much bigger pond. It's still a warm pond, but now the pond encompasses the entire surface of the Earth. And so life arises from a vast sea of concentrated prebiotics percolating, he says, not for a few hundred years. It's got to percolate for a billion years. He says, now we can get life coming out spontaneously by natural means. We make the pond a lot bigger. So he said basically his point was Charles Darwin was only right on the warm part. So he was wrong on everything else. You need a really big pond, literally covering the whole surface of the Earth, the entire waters of the Earth, and you need to have it percolate there for a billion years. Moreover, he says it's only going to work if you supersaturate the primordial ocean of the Earth with prebiotic chemicals. And so this develops several perspectives from an atheistic or non-theistic perspective, namely that you would anticipate that life would arise late, not early, because you need an enormous period of time for this percolation to do anything. That it would have to take place under benign conditions, not hostile conditions. You're going to need the warm part to be at an ideal temperature and the chemically consistent for a long period of time. The soup's going to have to be very big, and you're going to need abundant homo chirals. This is something that Carl Sagan did not bring up in his lecture series because at that time we weren't aware of just how severe the homo chirality problem was. What I'm getting at there is if you want to put together the building blocks of life to make life, then the amino acids need to be left-handed and the sugars need to be right-handed. Now, you could flip it the other way around, but the only way it's going to work is if all the amino acids have the same handed configuration, and all the sugars that make up the backbone of the RNA and the DNA would all have to have the same handed configuration. So amino acids, except for one of them, come in either a left-handed configuration or a right-handed configuration, and you can't put them together unless they're all left-handed or they're all right-handed. Likewise, the nucleotides that you're trying to put together, that can only happen if the sugars are all right-handed or all left-handed. The sugars are kind of the glue that puts together the chains of the nucleosides. So you're going to need abundant homo chirals, and we would anticipate that there'd be one very simple species only at the very beginning. And in the non-theistic literature, they refer to the first life as LUCA, which is the last universal common ancestor, making the idea that life begins with one bacterial species only from which all life naturally evolves. Now, that gives you two highly contrasting models. The thing I want you to notice here is that the predictions you see here are the very opposite of the predictions that Fuzron and I developed from the Bible based on what we anticipate for the origin of life. And in this context, we run into a number of life origin paradoxes. And Fuzz and I saw all of these laid out at the first Origin of Life research conference that we attended in San Diego. Namely, that we now recognize, now for at least the last 10 years, now about 10 years, only in the last 10 years has there been a recognition that in terms of the origin of life, Carl Sagan is wrong about the billions of years. Actually, Charles Darwin is more likely to be correct than Carl Sagan. Namely, that we now realize the origin of life occurred in a very narrow window of time, if any time at all. It's a time window that we can't measure. The error bars are such that it's less than the error bars. You say, how do we know that the origin of life took place without the benefit of time, mainly from the late heavy bombardment event, which we now have some considerable more knowledge about than we did when this was first recognized 10 years ago. The late heavy bombardment is referring to a period of time when all the planets in the inner solar system were being pelted by very big asteroids and comets. And we now understand what caused the late heavy bombardment. It was Jupiter and Saturn reaching a 1-2 resonance in their orbital movements, where Jupiter made exactly two orbits for every single orbit of Saturn. And what that did is it destabilized a huge belt of asteroids and comets, known as the Kuiper Belt. In fact, it reduced the Kuiper Belt to 1% of its former size. So today, the Kuiper Belt is only 1% of the size and mass that it was previous to this late heavy bombardment. Yes?
I remember before Christmas, you mentioned this late heavy bombardment drove the sulfur and some other materials that were in overabundance on the surface deep into the core.
Right.
What else was there besides sulfur that got driven down with that?
Well, what got driven down, there was some extra uranium and thorium that got driven down, so it did enrich the uranium and thorium content of the core. It also drove down some iron. But the most significant thing in terms of the structure of the inner core was the injection of oxygen and sulfur.
Oxygen.
It was oxygen and sulfur. There were some other light elements as well. But it's the oxygen and sulfur was the predominant light metal constituents that were driven into the interior of the Earth.
And still bubbling up to this day.
Well, that's the theory that's being proposed that I mentioned 2 weeks ago, is that the late heavy bombardment sent the sulfur and oxygen to the bottom part of the liquid core of the Earth. And that since that time, the oxygen and sulfur have been bubbling, or more correctly, diffusing up to the top layer of the inner core. And how that diffusion is driving the dynamo of the Earth. And they're offering that as an explanation for why the Earth has had such a strong magnetic field for the past 3.8 billion years, which is crucial for defending life on the Earth. Without that magnetic field, our atmosphere would have been sputtered away by the radiation coming out of the sun. So it's thanks to that bubbling up of the sulfur and the oxygen that we have a magnetic field strong enough that prevents our atmosphere from being blasted away by the sun's radiation. Yes? Well, when I took this class from him at the University of Toronto, he was saying is, I would really prefer more than a billion years to make this work, but he realized that a billion years was the maximum time. Back in the 70s, we were still trying to determine the date for the first life. Now we know that life was present here at 3.83 billion years ago. But when I heard these lectures from Carl Sagan, that was not yet established. And what he was saying in his lecture series is, I would love it if we had more than a billion years, but the truth is that's the maximum time that the historical record will permit us. So he says, let me take the full billion years. and we have this, you know, huge soup. Now, he did revise his model as time went on. In fact, when this late heavy bombardment became appreciated in the scientific literature, Carl Sagan and Christopher Chibba wrote an article on this. And basically, they were claiming that it was the late heavy bombardment that delivered this vast sea of prebiotics. Because at that time, they were saying, you know, where did the prebiotics come from? I haven't gotten to that part yet. But he proposed that it was the late heavy bombardment that brought the prebiotics in. But he also had to scale down the billion years to something more like 100 million years. But what I'm going to show you is we have to scale it down even more than that. So there was a question over here on this. No? Yeah. Well, where we're trying to get a good handle on what the maximum time window is getting a better understanding of the late heavy bombardment. That research is still in flux, but there's a woman by the name of Robin Knoop, who's very interested in this problem, and she's promising some research studies in the near future to try to get a better date for the late heavy bombardment. The dates I've seen in the scientific literature go between about 3.85 billion years ago for the peak of the late heavy bombardment to about 3.89. So it's about a 40 million year spread as to where that peak lies. Now, there's also research going on saying, okay, we have a pretty good idea what that peak was like. And how we get that is by looking at the craters on the Venus, Mercury, and Mars. Because those planets have so little erosion that we actually have a good record of when those craters were formed, and over 90% of them were formed by the late heavy bombardment. And so by looking at the erosion that we see on the craters of the Moon and the craters on Mercury and the craters on Mars, we can get a date for when this late heavy bombardment took place, but it's not as accurate a date as we'd like. There's a study going on comparing the craters of Mercury to the craters of the Moon, where they hope to be able to pin that down with greater precision. But right now, the error bars are about plus or minus 20 million years. So again, it's not as good as we would like. There's research going on as to when this 1-2 resonance of Jupiter and Saturn took place. It's consistent with 3.85 billion years, but again, the error bar is bigger than we would like, but there's promising research to narrow that error bar down. What we do have is a good date for when the first life shows up on planet Earth, which is 3.83 billion years ago. But regardless, 3.83 isn't very far away from 3.85, and it's not that far away from 3.89 billion years ago. Either way, we're looking at a few tens of millions of years and possibly much less than that. So this is the result of the conclusion. We're not looking at very much time. We may be able to really get that down to much greater precision probably in the next 2 or 3 years. Okay, you're next. Well, it's only important for atheists who are saying, you know, if we have enough time, maybe we can make our models work. So if you can squish the time down to a smaller and smaller value, that makes our models more and more problematic. But it is true over the past 5 years that time window has been getting smaller. Right. Well, this is the opinion of Niles Eldridge. And I'll just go to what Niles Eldridge said in his book. He said, in the very oldest rocks that stand a chance of showing the signs of life, we find those signs. Life is intrinsic to the Earth. And so he actually makes the conclusion, there's something about planet Earth's physics that means the very moment that you've got water and rocks, you're going to get life. And so he's kind of falling into the camp of saying there's some kind of hidden law of physics that will spontaneously make the life, but he's basically agreeing with you. He says the time window is already so tiny that it forces the conclusion that life must somehow be intrinsic to the Earth, because the very moment that we have rocks, this is the oldest rocks we see in the face of the Earth, we find the signatures of life in them. And therefore, I think I would agree with you that the time window, in some respects, is immaterial. Yeah, Al. Yeah. Well, Al, that's the very reason that Buzz and I chose the title for our book, Origins of Life, Plural. We were talking about the origin of the simplest life. But we put it in the plural because we felt there was a possibility that before the late heavy bombardment, if I can go back to this slide here, that before the late heavy bombardment, you got conditions, at least periodically, where life might be possible. In fact, there's research out there showing, looking at ancient zircons, and zircons are capable of surviving the heat impulse of the late heavy bombardment. And so we got zircons that take us back to 4.4 billion years ago. And some of those zircons tell us that there were brief episodes where liquid water did exist on the face of the Earth, which means that there'd be the possibility you could have rocks, which means there'd be the possibility that an aggressive creator may choose to create life even in a very narrow window of time which life could exist. And if you read our book, Origins of Life, we speculate as to why the Creator might choose to have life origins here rather than just here. If these few brief episodes of God creating life that gets quickly exterminated by bombardment events, that could possibly jumpstart the chemical transformation of the Earth's atmosphere. Now, right now the error bars on the chemical composition of the Earth's atmosphere are too large to tell us whether or not that would be a necessary ingredient to maximally pack the Earth with life after the late heavy bombardment. It could be, it may not be. We don't know. But well, I mean, you could say, you know, forget about this. Let's just have God creating life right here. Or have him create life here. But as the context of what we see in these creation texts is that God's goal is to give human beings, when he does create them, the maximum biological resources. So that would support the conclusion that God would want to get this going as early as possible. Now, any life that's created here isn't going to make it through the late heavy bombardment. It's going to be wiped out. Matter of fact, there's sufficient collision events here that any life that's made along here is going to get wiped out even before the late heavy bombardment.
Maybe. There's no proof that's true.
Well, the proof is that you would get a huge heat impulse as a result of one of these collision events. Well, there is one research paper that's claiming that maybe benthic life survived the late heavy bombardment. What they mean by that is bacterial life that exists thousands of feet below the floor of the ocean. And they're arguing that maybe that could have survived the heat impulse from the late heavy bombardment. But having read the paper, and you can see our comments on it on our website, we got three articles on it on our website, it only works if you stretch out this late heavy bombardment, and by stretching out that late heavy bombardment, you get repeated extermination events rather than just one extermination event. Well, the whole point is there a reason why God might want to have multiple creations here that he knows ahead of time aren't going to last very long? The only rationale we see it, and again, we're not claiming to know everything, but you know, from our limited perspective, we say, well, there could be a reason why God might want to do that if it's critical that that life that doesn't last very long and can't be that abundant because of the collision events that are taking place there, maybe it's that life that got a jump start on chemically transforming the Earth's atmosphere. And maybe that was important for what was going to happen thereafter. However, if there's no need to get involved early on the chemical transformation of life, then there'd be no need for God to create life here. And so right now we're agnostic on that issue. Maybe God intervened here, maybe he didn't. It all depends on whether or not the chemistry of the atmosphere would demand that kind of intervention. We just don't know. There's a question over here. Well, I'm assuming throughout all of this that God does not change the laws of physics that he creates in the beginning. And we've covered this before in the class, in that there is biblical evidence that God didn't do it. There's seven places in the Bible where it tells us the laws of physics don't change until God conquers and removes evil. And then there's measurements that we astronomers make where we look at the light from distant stars and galaxies that tells us the laws of physics throughout the entire history of the universe are the same as what we measure in the laboratory today. And so the whole question is, in the context of these laws of physics, would there be a need for God to jumpstart the transformation of the atmosphere? And what I'm saying is, we don't know whether that's necessary or not. But that's the reason why, we chose the title Origins of Life, was to leave open the possibility that maybe when we learn more about this, we would recognize that during these tiny episodes where liquid water did exist before the late heavy bombardment, God may have taken advantage of that to create some life that would begin some chemical transformation of the atmosphere. Maybe so, maybe not. Yes? When did the continents form? Well, they begin forming about here, and then they get really aggressive about here. I can pull up a chart for you which actually shows you exactly how the continents build up. The asteroids are hitting water, correct. And see, that's kind of a problem for the scenario that maybe life survived, because now you're turning the ocean into steam. And that's very catastrophic to even benthic life. And you're going to be heating up the crust. Well, okay, if you put the late heavy bombardment into a narrow time window, you transform the crust of the Earth and the mantle into, I mean, basically the Earth's surface is a liquid magma-type substance at least 300 kilometers deep. But there's some people who are arguing that maybe the late heavy bombardment was spread over a broader period of time. The evidence is not very strong for that, because we would expect a broader erosion signature on the Mars, Moon, and Mercury than we're seeing. And also, if we are right about Jupiter and Saturn being responsible for this late heavy bombardment, that would predict that you would get a fairly narrow envelope for this crashing in of asteroids and comets. But this is all stuff that's being worked out. As I say, you know, give us two or three more years. Keep coming to the class, and we'll be able to, you know, give you a much more definitive answer on that. I mean, it's very exciting research, and it's going on in multiple different arenas. And so, you know, there's going to be several different ways that we can get a more accurate answer on when the late heavy bombardment took place and how narrow of a pulse that late heavy bombardment is. And that's going to have a huge bearing on origin of life scenarios, both from a Christian and a non-Christian perspective. So that's something that I'm eagerly looking forward to, because that's really going to help us build a much more detailed origin of life model, which in turn could really help us in our discussions and dialogues not only with atheists, but with theistic evolutionists and evolutionary creationists. In the back, now.
With this whole picture, when did the water that reached here on the Earth, I think you said one time that the water came from comets.
Well, this gal I mentioned, Robin Knuth, she's done some research showing that the primordial Earth must have had a whole lot more water on it than it does now. It's really the only way the Moon can form the way it did, is that a planet about twice the size of Mars crept along the orbit of the Earth, collided with the Earth, where the Earth had a very deep ocean. And that will form the Moon in exactly the form that it has. But that this planet, twice the mass of Mars, colliding with the Earth with a very deep ocean, would cause at least 99% of the water to depart. And so Earth today has less than 1% of the water that it started with. But it's because of that event that the possibility exists for us to have continental land masses above sea level. Without that event, the plate tectonics would have never produced continents above sea level. So in that sense, we can thank God for the moon-forming event because it got rid of all that excess water. I forgot, 30 to 40 million years ago is the date that's being bandied around, and that's got an error bar of about 10 million years. Yeah, 30 to 40 million years after the formation of the Earth is when this planet twice the size of Mars collided with the Earth when it had a deep ocean. And it would have been a liquid water ocean. Yeah, it'd be about here when the event took place. So, and that transformed the core of the Earth, formed the Moon, got rid of the water, got rid of a lot of the carbon, life is possible because of the fact, largely because of that event that took place 30 million years after the Earth formed in the back.
On that chart, where is Genesis day one, creation day one?
Well, I would argue that creation day one would begin after the late heavy bombardment. So this would be creation day one, and then we go through the six creation days. I believe it refers to the entire universe. Oh, now you have light very soon after the creation of the universe. Literally within a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, you've got light.
So where is that?
Oh, way before the 4.6. You've got to go back to 13.7 billion years. Then you've got light.
But
Creation day one begins when you've got light coming through to the surface of the waters of planet Earth, and that would not happen until after the late heavy bombardment. It took the late heavy bombardment to get the atmosphere to a point where light could come through. Okay, over here. That's the predominant hypothesis. I mean, that's not 100% settled yet, but probably 90% of the planetary scientists would say, yes, that's the cause of the late heavy bombardment.
Did something significant happen prior to this relation? I mean, what was the disposition of the two planets before? And at this point, too, is the solar system still evolving? Is it establishing itself as a planet?
It was. Okay. What was going on before the late heavy bombardment is you had this giant belt of asteroids and comets. And it would have been centered approximately with the orbit of Saturn. Okay, the Kuiper belt now exists beyond the orbit of Neptune. So it exists from 4 to 6.5 billion miles away from the Sun. That's where it is now. But before the late heavy bombardment, it was much closer to the Sun and was at least 100 times bigger than it is now, and was approximately centered on the orbit of Saturn. But given the size of the Kuiper belt at that time, those objects would have dynamically interacted with Saturn, causing both the Kuiper belt and Saturn to move outward, away from the Sun. So at that point, Saturn was moving away from the Sun. Now, the Kuiper belt also overlapped Jupiter. but it wasn't as dense at Jupiter as it was at the orbit of Saturn. And therefore, Jupiter also was migrating outward, but not at the same speed that Saturn was migrating outward. By the way, Neptune and Uranus were also being influenced by the Kuiper Belt. So all four gas giants were moving outward, but the one that was moving outward at the greatest speed was Saturn. And so after a few hundred million years, what we have is Saturn moving far enough away at a faster rate than Jupiter that it reached a point where Jupiter was making two orbits for every single orbit of a Saturn. But what that does is sets up an instability, because that means that for every single orbit of Saturn, Jupiter is going to line up with respect to the Sun. And repeated incidences of that lineup will gravitationally destabilize the Kuiper Belt. Because here are the two most massive planets of the solar system. When you put Jupiter and Saturn together, that's more than 90% of the total mass of the solar system planets.
Was it literally like bowling ball and bowling pins too? Where the, you know, Saturn and Jupiter were going through the Kuiper Belt and the gravitational forces were greatly disturbing these asteroids.
Well, there would be disturbances going on even before the 1-2 resonance. But with the 1-2 resonance, you get a gigantic disturbance. And it basically disperses almost all of the Kuiper Belt objects. So a whole bunch of them left the solar system. A whole bunch moved in towards the Sun. And that explains all the cratering, or most of the cratering, we see on the Moon, Jupiter, Moon, Mercury, and Mars. And by the way, if you get your pair of binoculars out tonight and look at the Moon, well, maybe not tonight, a couple of nights from now, look at the Moon, and you see all those craters, and realize as much damage as you see on the face of the Moon, Earth took 30 times the damage that the Moon did. So we took by far the biggest hit from the late heavy bombardment in terms of the inner solar system planets. But again, people are very aggressive today, trying to get a better model of that destabilization event, also getting a better picture of the cratering incidents on those three inner solar system bodies, so we can determine exactly what kind of damage the Earth took, over what time window it took, and what that would mean for the origin of life. Okay, there's a whole bunch of hands here, so I don't know who's first, but let me go with you, John. Okay, it's a dynamical interaction between the gas giant planets and all these little small bodies of asteroids and comets. And you know, it creates almost a drag-like phenomena that causes them to move outward. And once the dispersal takes place, they stop migrating. So since the late heavy bombardment, there's not been enough debris out there to change the orbital distance of any of the gas giant planets. So they're migrating outward. And then after the late heavy bombardment, basically that put the brakes on the migration. Yeah, depending on the situation, you can get them migrating inward or migrating outward. And so there are models where planets will interact with debris, comets, asteroids, and dust, so that they migrate inward. It depends how far away you are from the star. It depends on the mass of the star, whether you get an outward migration or an inward migration. No, it's not. That's not what's going on. No. Yeah. I mean, again, it's so easy, you know, based on our training, to think of this as a simple two-body problem. It's not. In fact, it was only in the last 10 years that astronomers even determined that you would get any migration at all. So it's only in the last 10 years that we've realized that planets will migrate. Matter of fact, what stimulated all this was the discovery of extrasolar planets, where they were finding gas giant planets orbiting really close to the star. And we knew already that there's no way a gas giant planet's going to form close to its star. It's too hot. It's going to drive away those light gases. And so that's what convinced astronomers the planets had to form far away, and somehow they drifted inwards. And that's what stimulated the research studies to say, well, how could they possibly drift inwards? And then they built these computer models where they said, well, if we actually had the planet dynamically interacting with hundreds of thousands of small bodies, they discovered that they could get them drifting inward or outward. But depending on the distances and the masses of the gas giant and the star and the kind of debris you're dealing with, you either get an inward or outward, and then you get them migrating at a slower or faster rate. And again, the research is still underway, but this is so complicated, it took the discovery of extrasolar planets even to get people to say, let's ask the government for money so that we can build these supercomputers that can actually do these kinds of models. It can only be done on really big computers. But now we're actually being able to apply it to the origin of life problem. That's what's exciting. Yeah. Temporarily, that's exactly what you're looking at. Yeah, the bombardment would be, it would give a huge heat impulse, which would turn the liquid water into vapor. So, yeah, for a while, there would be no ice or liquid water on the face of the Earth.
Or rocks.
Yes.
Could you give us a 5-minute wrap-up?
Okay, 5-minute wrap-up. Let's see if we can move this a little farther along. All right. Well, I think you're getting an idea of just, what's so exciting to all these different kinds of astronomers and chemists and geologists is that you get people from multiple disciplines that are actually coming up with conclusions that are relevant to a very crucial issue, the origin of light. But let me go back to Niles Eldridge's comment here, where he said, in the very oldest rocks that stand a chance of showing signs of life, we find those signs. Life is intrinsic to the Earth. And we can continue debating what this late heavy bombardment is going to be like, but already we know enough to realize that in terms of the origin of life, it took place in a very small window of time, or maybe no time at all. We know that it's less than, at most, 10 million years. So it's 10 million years or less that we're looking at the origin of life. And so this is an immediate challenge to non-theistic interpretations of the origin of life, the fact that we don't have a billion years plus, we're only looking at 10 million years or less, and given future research, we may be able to narrow that time window down a lot more. But it's such that the science allows for not much more than a 10 million year window. And so this is the basis of the conclusions that we see taking place in the scientific community, that there must be some hidden law of physics that explains the origin of life, because if we're looking at 10 million years or less, there's really no possible, you were the one that laid out the probabilities. In terms of trying to put together these molecules under naturalistic scenarios, you're going to need a lot of time. Well, yeah, if you're looking at most model calculations, you're going to need more than 10 billion times the age of the universe. But, not all scientists really appreciate those kinds of numbers, but they do know that 10 million years isn't a lot of time. And so if we're looking at only 10 million years, it's like, what hope do we have for a naturalistic explanation of the origin of life? And incidentally, all non-theistic models for the origin of life need time. The only models that don't are the models that appeal to a hidden law of physics. But we'll discuss that next week, why it's not possible for there to be a law that would be hidden and yet capable of explaining the origin of life without a divine miraculous intervention. Or as my colleague Buzz Rana says, yes, there is a hidden law of physics. You spell it G-O-D. It's God that intervenes with physics from outside the universe to make possible the origin of life. And so in that sense, you know, they're on track. But numerous scientists today are saying that the only way we can explain this without invoking God is that there be some special law of physics that spontaneously creates the life all by itself. Of course, that raises the question, how come we don't see it today? Well, maybe that law only existed at that time. Anyway, we'll get into some discussion as to why you can't hide that kind of law. If such a law really exists, there's no way that scientists would not see that law. But what we'll talk about next week is you've got a double problem. Not only is there no time, there is no soup. Now, if you don't have any building blocks, how can there be a naturalistic origin of life model? If you've got no building blocks and you've got no time, you've got no naturalistic model. Every naturalistic model needs those two ingredients. They need at least some amount of time, and they at least need some soup. And the case of the soup issue, as we're going to see next week, we can rule out the fact that there's any kind of a soup. It's not just that we have an error bar that we don't know what it is. There is good physics and chemistry that tells us that planet Earth never had a primordial soup. And so if you don't have any building blocks, how can some natural law of physics put the stuff together? You don't have that to start with. So look at some of the evidence for why we're lacking the prebiotics on the face of the Earth. So we'll pick that up next time. And I thought I could get through this more quickly, but hey, it's been fun getting through some of the stuff on the late heavy bombardment. I think we all now appreciate, you know, what an amazingly designed planet we live on, that it had an event that formed the moon, got rid of the excess water, got rid of the excess carbon, set up the core of the Earth so that we could have a strong magnetic field, and also set up the core in such a way that it would generate future continents. And now we also have the late heavy bombardment, which infused the oxygen and the sulfur into the liquid core of the Earth and transformed the core in such a way that we human beings can exist today. So next year when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you